Blog Talk Radio. Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Oh, yeah. Hey, I'm Carol the Coach, and I can tell that I need to revamp my intro. Sorry about that. I hear it fading in and out, and I will make that my project for this week. As if I didn't have enough to do, I just got back from ITAP, which is the International Institute of Training Addictions and Trauma Professionals, and that's where Patrick Carnes put together this group of people to help educate us about certified sexual addiction and partners of sexual addiction, and I mean, it has been amazing. But what I know to be true is that people that have the addiction of sexual disorder or partners who love a sex addict, they need specialized training. Unfortunately, the average person does not know what to do in this kind of situation. And so there were, you know, I'm not sure how many people were there actually. We're about 1,500 strong, and I'd say there was a good 500 or 600, and we got updated information. I personally took a refresher course. I always want to make sure that I've got the newest and most informed information that I can get. I presented, if you've been listening to the show, you know that I presented on post-traumatic growth, which I really believe in. And so, what can I say? It was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. And, you know, so often I work with sex addicts that have urges and cravings, and that can be tough to manage. And I work with partners who have triggers that put them into full-fledged panic attacks and anxiety. And so tonight I'm going to be talking with an expert who's going to be sharing with us, how do you cope with the triggers? Now, if you're an addict, I encourage you to listen. Why? Because you need to also help your partner in the best way you can. You know, I was talking with an addict today, and he said, I had actually seen an old acting out partner, but I didn't want to tell my wife that I had even seen her because I knew it was going to throw her into a full-fledged panic attack. And boy, that sounds really thoughtful of him, doesn't it? He did not want to trigger her. But the number one thing she has asked for is to have him be 100% honest. And so with him not sharing seeing her, it threw her into more post-traumatic stress. So I know that it can be terribly, terribly difficult to love somebody and see them go into the stress, but I promise you that they want to know that you're going to be honest at any expense. That is my promise to you. They absolutely want to know that they can count on you to be honest, since you've lived a life pretty much of very little honesty. And so, you know, this guy is such a nice guy, but he's been told that before. And ultimately, not only did he not want to see his wife be triggered, but he didn't want to have to think that, oh my gosh, even though he's working good recovery, he is not, he's not in a situation where he can feel like, okay, I'm not triggering my wife anymore. Now, you and I both know that if you're an addict and you are in good recovery, but something comes up that throws your wife or husband, depending on who the partner is, into full-fledged panic and anxiety, that's just kind of what you have to deal with. You have to deal with the aftermath to get through it and to get healthy and to really help her work through it. So I said to him, now you know she's been really clear with you. She wants you to talk about who you've seen, what you've dealt with, regardless of whether you've acted out or not. She wants that information. She wants to know that you're bringing her honesty. And so I would encourage any addict out there to bring your wife honesty by being 100% transparent about who you see and what is going on in your life. And so we're going to be talking with Vicki Tidwell Palmer, who is going to be sharing how do you deal with triggers? What can you do to self-soothe? How can you get through this when it just seems like, wow, ever going to stop? Is it ever going to get better? I 100% understand that. And my promise to you is, yes, it will. It is going to get better. But you're going to have to do the hard work of learning how to self-soothe and regulate. And when you do, it will make all the difference in the world. Okay, now that is what I promise. You know, they say as a therapist, don't make any promises because you can't necessarily hold true to them. But that's something that I promise I can hold true. If you're being more and more and more honest, you definitely will be able to make your partner feel more and more and more comfortable. It may not seem so today, but it will get better and better and better. And it takes a while. This condition, this addiction, takes 3 to 5 years to repair. So it's going to take the partner a while to really trust that you mean what you say and you say what you mean. I know you're probably sitting there thinking, I don't know if I believe it, but that's my guarantee to you because I've seen it work over the years. You have to be consistent. You have to do it right every single time. And you and I both know that's hard. It is the easy road to say, hey, I'm not going to share with her that. But I don't know. Who knows why it works out that whatever you don't share, you get caught on. And we don't want you to get caught. We want, even if she goes into some trauma, we want you to have done the right thing. So, what do you know to be true? What in your program use some tweaking or some improving? Only you know what that is. You know, maybe it is that you actually need more bonding time with your partner. Maybe it's that, you know, your therapist told you to have check-ins and you just haven't been as rigorous with sharing how your week's going, how you're feeling, what struggles you're having, and what you want to do to connect to your partner. Now, in therapy, I have this exercise, and it goes like this. How would you rate the quality of your relationship from 1 to 10? 10 being fantastic, 1 being not so much. Now, let's say that your partner looks at you and says, oh, I'd rate it a 4. The next thing you say to her or him is, what would it take to make it a 5? In other words, we're not looking for absolute perfection. We're looking for improvement. And maybe your partner would say, I'd like you to cuddle with me more at bedtime. Or maybe your partner would say, I'd like for you to take care of the kids at night. Or maybe your partner would say, I'd like to have more one-on-one time and know that I'm not making a choice that makes you feel like I don't care about you. Now, that's a great exercise to try, and I'm going to ask you to do that. Again, it's simple. It goes like this. Why don't you rate our relationship from 0 or from 1 to 10? What number would you give our relationship today? 10 being that it's absolutely great, 1 being that we need to make improvements. They pick a number, and whatever number they have, you bump it up one more. Well, you set our relationship's a 7. What would it take to make it an 8? And then listen intently for whatever it would take to improve your relationship. That is a regular marital assignment that I give anybody, but it works with addicts and their partners. And if you're a partner listening to this show, this really does apply to your spouse, because let's face it, if you don't talk about the hard things, they don't get talked about. And I really want you to make the most out of your marriage, because this is not a dress rehearsal. This is about taking your life to the next level. And that's what I want you to do. Okay, that is a simple assignment that you can do to make your life better. And it doesn't take much work, but it does require a check-in at least 1 to 2 times a week. And that's why I really want you to work on making your life the best possible. Can you do that for me? Excellent, excellent, excellent. Okay, so now, I am really looking for lots of ways that you can feel competent, capable. And I know that's hard. You know, when you are in a situation where clearly, you know, you feel like you've messed up big time. Or if you're a partner, you feel like, you know, the relationship is not going to get any better. Then what you've got to do is really work on tweaking it in just very small, chunkable ways. Can you do that? I know you can. That's how much I believe in you. So, here we go. What's one thing you can do to improve the relationship? Let me know. Let me know what you need. And let me know that you can make it happen. Let me know what you can do for your partner, because you are willing to do whatever it takes to make it the best relationship possible. All right, I'm Carol the Coach, and this is Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And, you know, you can get on my Carol the Coach website, which is not about, it's not about sex addiction. It's just about making your life different. And there are probably 600 blogs and articles to make your life better, to create the life you deserve. And I want you to give that a shot. I am so excited because I am going to be interviewing Vicki Tidwell-Palmer, and she is going to be talking about triggers, because let's face it, triggers are those unmistakable physical and emotional reactions that a partner has to the trauma they've experienced in their past. So, Vicki, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carol. It's great to be here. How are you?
Yes, boy. You have taken on a big topic, and I've got so many people that wonder, what can they do to actually make this process a little bit easier? Because obviously, triggers can be very conscious. You know, you can say to yourself, all right, I know I've got this trigger, so I'm going to do everything I can to not be triggered. Or they can just pop up intermittently in your sleep. When you're taking a shower or when the phone rings. So I really appreciate that you're willing to talk about this topic tonight.
Yeah, I think it's a really important topic. And also, you know, one of the things that I notice for partners early on in early discovery and disclosure is that even before discovery, they will start having panic episodes that they really don't even know where they're coming from. And I definitely believe that those are a result of deception and betrayal and just the effects of active addiction. So, you know, there are a lot of tools and strategies that partners can use, and it's helpful to get as much information and to get all those tools on board for when they pop up, because, like you said, they can happen when you're not expecting. There are sometimes partners talk about being triggered, like, you know, they'll do a particular thing 10 times, and then the 11th time it's a big trigger, and that's confusing for partners as well. So I think it's a big topic, it's an important topic, but it's also complex, because I think partners also need to distinguish sometimes between just managing a trigger and then setting boundaries.
Absolutely, and like you have said before, they're kind of unexpected and unwelcome events or situations that create painful and sometimes debilitating symptoms, such as panic or anxiety or panic disorder. So tell me a little bit about some of the people that you've worked with and some of the experiences they've had that have had to do with their either post-traumatic stress disorder or their panic disorder.
Yeah, in terms of the panic episodes or the panic disorder or having anxiety attacks, those typically happen more in the either pre-discovery or early discovery stages. And they'll happen in situations that you would not necessarily associate with sex addiction or sexual betrayal. So even everyday events like just being on the freeway, which, I mean, that's stressful in and of itself, but, you know, driving on the freeway or going to a grocery store and just, you know, being in a store, for example, those are actually very common times for partners early on to have panic episodes. And I've seen that in several clients. And they can manifest in a lot of different ways. And, you know, when this happens, it's really helpful to figure out how to help partners manage these, because sometimes they go away quickly, and sometimes partners can do just very simple things. Like, I've had partners who've tried tapping. I don't know if you're familiar with tapping, but EFT or tapping is a tool that has been very helpful for partners. And there's just, you know, a lot of different strategies, including, you know, even in advance, doing a lot of really good self-care and making sure that you're taking care of yourself physically and emotionally and spiritually. But, you know, it's almost endless the way that triggers can manifest. And what I always say is that triggers are highly individualized. And so sometimes what will trigger one partner does not trigger another partner at all. And I encourage partners not to be, you know, not to judge themselves around that, because they may wonder, well, why is this so activating or triggering for me, but it's not to another person? And there are so many different reasons why that may be the case. You know, the partner's temperament, their own history, the particular betrayal that they've experienced. So, you know, I think it's important for partners to realize that really anything can be a trigger. A facial expression, a person, it's just really limitless.
Now, so for some of our partners, they may even say, how do I know if I am triggered? Let's go into some of the symptomatology that says, hey, you've been triggered.
Yeah, I mean, some of the ones that are the most obvious, and I think for most partners, they know right away, because almost always there are physical sensations and symptoms that partners have. And we, you know, talked about the panic episodes, and most of the time when those happen, people will experience an increased heart rate, or they'll perspire, or there can be kind of a sense of losing time, or, you know, not being able to redirect attention or to focus. Also, partners can go into fight, flight, or freeze responses. And so, for example, a fight response would be to, you know, literally like it sounds, you might want to lash out in some way, you know, throw something, hit something, that sort of thing. For a flight response, the partner may have the urge to literally get up and leave, which sometimes that's a very healthy response. And actually, I'd say all of these are normal and healthy responses. Some of them have to be managed, for example, fight. But flight could be just wanting to run away or just get out of the situation. And then freeze is just what it sounds like. You literally just feel frozen in place, or you don't know what to say next. You don't know what to do. And so those are just some of the ways that triggers feel for partners.
Absolutely. And it is very important for partners to be aware of and understand their specific triggers so that they'll know whether they should go into self-care mode or, you know, do some breathing or visualization. And like you said, I'm very aware of the tapping technique. Can you share with people what the tapping technique is all about?
Well, and I'm not trained in tapping, so I can't give like a really detailed explanation of how it works. I've done it myself. I've in the past in certain therapy that I've been in, I've had my own therapist have taught me tapping. But really, it's just it's very much systematized. And so the person who teaches you tapping will tell you specific places to tap on your body. Often it's like a combination of on the face, and then also on the chest, and it usually goes along with some kind of statement about, you know, basically just being okay in the moment. Like, you know, in spite of the fact that I'm triggered right now, or in spite of the fact that this has happened, I'm safe and I'm calm, or something like that. So I think it's worth checking out, you know, if you have somebody in your area that knows tapping or EFT, because I know it has been helpful for partners.
Absolutely. And, you know, there is the Tapping Institute that's run by, Ulner, and he actually helps you to butterfly tap, which is actually to put your arms around yourself and begin to tap and breathe and make a positive statement about being in control. And as simple as that sounds, it's almost that bilateral stimulation, being able to tap one shoulder and then the next, as you're giving yourself a butterfly hug, it calms the body down. There are all sorts of techniques that can help with panic attacks and triggers. So did I hear you say that your therapist, he or she actually helped you with this?
Yeah, this was years ago when I was in therapy. I happen to not be in therapy at the moment. And by the way, I think that all therapists at some point need to be in therapy. I'll just add that. But yeah, at some point in the past, I had a therapist. It was actually a woman who taught me tapping.
Okay. Now, what else would you advise partners to do when they need to self-soothe and calm themselves down?
Well, there are a variety of tools. And, you know, this is what I think of in terms of unavoidable triggers, because there are some triggers that are unavoidable, and they do tend to kind of come out of nowhere. And so it's helpful to have, you know, a variety of things to call on. I think that the things that can help immediately is if you even pre-trigger, so prior to having the trigger, that you can have certain phrases or prayers or mantras or positive self-talk, anything like that, that you can immediately call on to calm the situation down. I mean, even something as simple as all is well, or a scripture particularly meaningful to you. And I encourage partners, when they're trying to pick these sort of go-to phrases or prayers, to really see how it feels in their body as they say it. So when they're calm, you know, sort of trying these out and finding out what kind of impact it has on their nervous system, because those are the ones that you'll know are very powerful that you can use. And I even encourage people to write these down and keep them in, you know, you can even tape something to the dashboard of your car. You can have something on your phone as a screensaver on your computer to just remind you of these kinds of things. But, you know, journaling is helpful, learning how to do basic meditation. And I've been a practitioner of meditation and mindfulness for about 25 years. And I often teach partners mindfulness techniques or how to do just simple meditation, just being aware, you know, bringing awareness to the in-breath and the out-breath. That is one of the best tools to use, because your breath is available anytime. It's one of the few things that we can count on. I encourage partners
to... So if you were helping a client to do that, how would you sit her down and what would you tell her to do?
Well, I'd first of all just ask her to tune into her body and to just notice what she's feeling. And sometimes just that in and of itself can be a lot to do, because especially if there's been a lot of anxiety, it can be difficult for a partner to tune into their body. But I would just ask them to orient, you know, first of all, to the space around them, just to notice the room that they're in, you know, any colors or texture or shapes or anything like that. And then bring awareness to the body and the physical sensations, and then to the breath. And, you know, it's helpful to notice the sensations of the in-breath and the out-breath, but most of us experience that in different places, meaning sometimes we notice it in our abdomen, the in-breath and the out-breath, or sometimes in the chest. So you just find where you feel the in-breath and the out-breath most, and then you just start to notice that. You're just being curious and paying attention, and you don't need to try to breathe in any different way. You're just noticing and being aware. And the thing that people need to know about meditation that I think is kind of a misunderstanding is that there's an idea that your mind is going to stay on what you're choosing to focus on without wandering, and that is just absolutely not the case. And so I encourage people, when I'm teaching them meditation and mindfulness, to really expect that their mind is going to wander, but every time they can bring their awareness back to the in-breath and the out-breath. And the beauty of this practice is that you can do it even if you're with other people, even if you're having a conversation. And, you know, like I said before, the awareness of the breath, it's just so powerful, because no matter what, it's always there. If you're conscious, it's there, and it's something that you can tune into, and it has an almost immediate calming effect.
Well, that's interesting, because clearly it doesn't get much more simple than that, and yet that is a very important technique to slow that central nervous system down, and it kind of calms both the amygdala the frontal cortex. I mean, it really sends messages that you're going to be okay.
Exactly.
So now, you and I were both at the ITAP conference, and we learned a lot of information about what is the most self-soothing exercises that we can do with addicts and partners. What techniques did you learn at ITAP that you thought were especially helpful with our clients that are partners?
In terms of self-soothing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you went to Sue Neufeld Ellis's presentation on mindfulness and recovery. Did you happen to go to that session?
No, I didn't, but I did get her card, and we're going to have her on the show.
Oh, fantastic. I really enjoyed her session, and, you know, even though I've been practicing meditation for a very long time, I learned some new things in that particular session. But, you know, I want to just bring some awareness to the impact of thoughts on triggers and in terms of emotional regulation, because in order to have emotional regulation, we have to have a good balance between our thoughts and our emotions. And one of the things that I've noticed for partners that actually makes it more difficult to practice emotional regulation is not being aware of the thoughts that they're having that go along with triggers. And I call them toxic thoughts. And so an example of that would be thinking something like, you know, if I had just done what he asked me to do sexually, then he wouldn't have been unfaithful. Or if I was more attractive, or if I looked like her, or whatever the case may be. Those kinds of toxic thoughts, especially when they're not conscious, they can really exacerbate and make triggers far worse. So when I'm working with partners, I'm always asking about any thoughts that are associated with triggers, because if they go unnoticed and they're not identified, it's difficult to make any headway around really doing the good emotional regulation work. And I think there does need to be a balance between the thinking and the emotions, and to be aware of both of those.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And it sounds like her workshop would be good. You know, we get to obviously order the CDs, and it sounds like that would be a very valuable CD to get. Now, what would you say, why are some triggers more intense than people probably think they should be?
Yeah, and that one really is related to what I was just talking about in some ways around thoughts, because if there are toxic thoughts that are related to triggers, you know, for example, like if a partner drives by a sexually oriented business or somewhere like that, somewhere that's triggering, and the thought pops up, you know, if I just look like the women that worked in there, then my partner wouldn't have acted out, or my partner's more attracted, or the sex addict is more attracted to them than he is to me, for example. Those kind of thoughts will make triggers worse. And there are other things, too, that can make triggers worse, like there's a concept that I call familiar themes related to triggers, and familiar themes are things that they sort of re-stimulate some trauma experience, and I don't mean from the addiction, but like a childhood trauma. And so, you know, like if we noticed that when we were younger, our father was, you know, consistently flirting with other women in front of our mother, and then we fast forward to today, and our partner is doing the same thing, even though that's inappropriate and that's something that the partner would definitely want to set a boundary around, that trigger of the flirting may be exponentially more powerful because it has with it this long history and experience from family of origin trauma, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. It's kind of like the accumulative response. You see it in your partner, the addict, and you've also seen it or grown up with it with your family of origin, and so it has exponential intensity.
Right, and, you know, it can be also a matter of temperament because, you know, we're all individuals and we have different temperaments and those things too. There's a lot of factors that can go into why they can feel more intense than you think that they might.
Now, how did you get to be such an expert working with partners? What was your drive? What compelled you to say, I want to work with this population?
You know, I would take it back to even when I was in graduate school, I happened to see Pat Carnes. I'm in Houston. I'm in private practice in Houston, and this was many years ago, and he came to Houston. And at that time, I really didn't even think about becoming a CSAT. But after I saw him present in Houston at a conference, I decided that I wanted to do it. And then as I started working with partners and sex addicts, because I've worked with both, I still work with both, I just really get a lot of satisfaction working with partners and seeing the transformation and their empowerment over time and their ability to set boundaries. And, you know, really I just find their resilience and their courage and their strength to be just inspiring. So that's the Reader's Digest short version of how I came to be working with partners.
Okay, so in lots of ways you were inspired by their strength and their resiliency.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure you've probably had this experience as a therapist, that one of the things that makes, you know, being a therapist very rewarding is to see the transformation of clients. And, you know, I've seen so much transformation in the partners that I've worked with. And, in fact, I have a partners group that meets on Monday mornings, and the meeting was this morning. And, you know, I just, every time that group ends, I'm just so kind of blown away. And these are women who've been in recovery for, you know, 3 to 5 years or longer. They've been on this path for a long time. You know, the way that they support each other and just their courage and strength and also clarity is, it's just very rewarding to work with them.
I bet. You know, we all have our special populations that we are either, we admire their courage or their resiliency, or we admire the trauma they've been through and know that they can actually make sense of it eventually, and we want to be a part of that. And certainly, I have to tell you, Vicki, I have never worked with a population that has been through so much pain. I've worked with sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. I've worked with veterans, but partners of sexual addiction really have been through a lot of pain, in part because the addicts didn't know, you know, about disclosure. They didn't know how to share information all at one time, so the partner was re-traumatized. You know, there aren't necessarily good therapists out there that know what to do. This is really kind of a pioneering field. And so... Mm-hmm. That, coupled with what you were talking about earlier, that a lot of times partners actually have family of origin issues that kind of parallel the life they're living right now. I have always been amazed when somebody can read some great partner books, attend groups like yours or Marsha Means, and they get healthier, they get stronger, they get more empowered, they have better boundaries, they learn how to assert themselves. And they become their own person in a new and different way as a result of the trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is remarkable. And I have heard partners say this. And for, you know, for any partners that are listening who are very new to discovery and disclosure, this is probably going to sound very unbelievable. But I have had partners tell me that being in relationship with a sex addict, and this is, you know, well into healing and growth, that it was really one of the best things that happened for them because it got them into their own path of healing And sometimes healing things that happen way before their relationship, things that they don't believe that they would have addressed if they hadn't been through it. So, you know, I've heard of people, you know, checking in at or introducing themselves at a 12-step meeting saying that, you know, they're a grateful partner of a sex addict. And, you know, that's a whole other level, but it really speaks to that resilience and courage and strength that I mentioned before.
Absolutely. And so, you know, one of the questions that I have for you is when you're dealing with an addict and you're dealing with the partner, is it okay for the partner to ask the addict to stop doing things that are triggering?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I tell clients, you know, partners and addicts alike or anybody, is the truth is about requests is that we can ask anybody for anything, right? I mean, you can make a request for anything. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll get it. But when I think about partners and triggers, I see these being in two different categories. So, for example, there are things that are triggers for partners that are absolute boundary issues. And just one that I'm thinking of off the top of my head is that if you are married to a sex addict who's maybe one of their primary acting out behaviors is looking at internet pornography, and you have several young children at home, and the addict has used the computer to look at pornography, that is an example of something, like, for example, if the partner gets triggered when they get on the computer and they may get exposed to pornography or, you know, emails or something like that on the computer, that trigger is also an example of a boundary that needs to be set. And the reason that that is a very clear and kind of unequivocal boundary is that it involves the protection of children. And so in that case, that's a boundary that really the partner can do something about herself. She can do what needs to be done with the computer in order to protect her children, but also, you know, by extension herself from that particular trigger. So there are boundaries like that. It also could be a boundary that she needs to make a request of the addict. And so those, I really like to distinguish between issues of being triggered by something where there definitely needs to be a boundary of some kind set, or something that's a trigger that is just, here's an example. I remember a partner who became very triggered by a T-shirt that the addict had, and there was something written. It wasn't inappropriate, but there was something written on the T-shirt that for her was very triggering. It wasn't offensive. It really had nothing to do with the addict's acting out history, but it was just very triggering. So that's an example where if the partner wanted to, she could say, you know, when you're wearing that T-shirt, I just get really triggered and activated, and I would like it if you did not wear that T-shirt anymore. And, you know, the reality is that the addict may say yes, no, or you know, want to negotiate some kind of alternative solution. In this particular case, the addict actually threw the T-shirt away because the addict realized that, you know, it just wasn't worth it, this T-shirt. So, you know, yeah, you can definitely ask for any kind of change of behavior to reduce a trigger. And at the same time, you have to realize we can't make demands of other people. Adults can't demand another adult to do something, but you can make a request. And, you know, then if the request isn't accepted, then you may have to figure out what to do after that, either to manage the trigger, or there could be some kind of boundary that needs to happen as a result of that. But, yeah, I mean, going back to the original question, absolutely, you can make a request for a boundary or some kind of behavior change in order to either, you know, reduce or eliminate a trigger.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had a man tonight. Now, he has really, as an addict, he has done a great job of stopping all of his acting out behaviors. And his wife continues to get triggered when he avoids being honest with her. So, for instance, he saw an old acting out partner while he was at a conference. And he was going to tell her. I mean, that's been an issue for them. She has said, I want to know when you see your old acting out partners. So he said, I got in the taxi. I was ready to tell her. And he called her and he said, hey, babe, what's going on? She said, do you know what? This is the first weekend I have felt free. I have felt like I have let go of a lot of my baggage. I am so happy. And what did he do? He immediately said, oh, I'm not going to ruin her day. I'll tell her tonight when I get home. And then she was so happy when he got home. He said, oh, man, I'm going to have to tell her tomorrow. I cannot watch her go into Triggerville. So he made that turn into a three-day process. And when he did tell her at the end of the weekend that he had run into this old acting out partner, she went ballistic. She got triggered.
Right.
She said, you're a liar. You're a bastard. I hate you. You know, this is it. We're getting a divorce. And in actuality, he had done nothing wrong in terms of acting out. But he did everything wrong in terms of acting out because he dealt with the core issue, which was he lied to her. Made her think things were a certain way when they weren't. And in all fairness to him, he did not want to ruin the moment because he felt so happy that she was happy. But what he did was he prolonged the inevitable, and he told her, and there she was re-triggered again because he had made that commitment to be honest with her, and he had not done so. So she got triggered.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, that story is a great example of why it's so important to have very specific agreements around disclosing these kinds of things. And it reminds me of a phrase that I learned from, I can't remember if it was Rob Weiss or Sharon O'Hara, but and I say it all the time to addicts, but it's tell the truth and tell it faster. Because it is always better, even if the partner is having a great weekend or a great hour or a great week or whatever she's having, I can promise you that all partners want to know the truth sooner rather than later. And so having agreements like, you know, I'm going to disclose a slip within a certain time frame, or if I see an old acting out partner, I will tell you within a certain time frame. And that way it's very clear. And I think, too, that this is a certain phase in the addict's recovery where he, and by the way, I'm, you know, using these pronouns, and I don't mean to exclude people because I'm very aware that, you know, partners can be male or female and addicts can be male or female, but I just use the pronouns to make it simple to talk about. But the addict, this is a kind of a predictable phase in the recovery process, where there's still this distorted thinking around just being very rigorously honest and very transparent and forthcoming. And, you know, there's just a lot of distorted thinking that goes into making those kind of choices not to share. Because I think on some level, addicts know that it's going to be worse if they choose to wait and share the information later.
Oh, 100%. So let's hear what Rob or Sharon said to you. They said, tell the truth and tell it faster?
Yes, tell the truth and tell it faster. And it's a great phrase. Yeah, it's really great.
Right, and you know what I said to him tonight? Actually, he was one of my group members. And what I said to him tonight was, she probably would have been triggered anyway. And at the same time, it would have been less of a trigger, it would have been you being honest, and the consequence that you would have had to deal with would have been much more workable. And by prolonging the inevitable, you are telling her that you can't be trusted, even when you can. She knows
right.
that you can't because you won't do it within the contracted amount of time, which for them had been 24 hours, and then she said, you know what, I can't wait 24 hours. I need to know the minute you talk to me on the phone, the minute you text me, the the minute I see you face to face.
Right. Yeah, well, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Absolutely.
That she would want to know that.
But now,
I just want to add, that's one of the reasons why when I give guidelines for couples around doing couples check-ins, I always have the addict tell their sobriety date as the very first thing, because sometimes I'd have partners come in and they would describe to me the check-ins they were doing, but the sobriety date didn't come till like the very end. So the partner, and I don't think addicts fully appreciate this, but the partner's very, very, on a high alert because they don't know whether or not the addict has acted out or not. So, you know, again, tell the truth and tell it faster needs to be a motto.
Absolutely. Now, you know, you had said you see that there are some similarities and differences between partner triggers and addict triggers. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, they're more than you might think, because the first way that they're similar is that they're unavoidable. I mean, both partners and addicts, they're going to have triggers, and there really is just no way to avoid them for both parties. The other thing is that they're distressing, and sometimes partners find this maybe hard to believe, that addicts can be distressed when they're triggered, but especially an addict that's very serious about their recovery, when a trigger comes up, it can be distressing for them. So they're unavoidable, they're distressing, and then also they can be managed with tools. So there are tools that partners can use to manage their triggers, and then addicts have all kinds of tools that they can utilize for triggers, like, you know, the 3-second rule and, you know, tons of other tools like that. The other similarity is that the triggers lessen over time. And this is really the good news for partners and for addicts, is that, you know, with the combination of getting tools and doing the work that needs to be done, and just really the passage of time as well, that they do lessen over time. And there are some things that for partners in particular early on that can be highly triggering, that if you check in with them 3 or 5 years later, they may not even remember that that was a trigger, and that can just be a huge relief. Another similarity is that the triggers may be a result of trauma. This is always true for partners, for sure. However, it can also be true for addicts, because sometimes, depending on the addict's history, they may have a trauma history that gets sort of reenacted in the present, or gets reactivated in some way. It's not always true for addicts, but it sometimes is, that their triggers are related to a past trauma. So there really are quite a few similarities.
And so how often do you work with addicts?
Regularly. I mean, I have I work with addicts right now in individual therapy, and I also have group psychotherapy with addicts. That's a once-a-week group. I've probably done close to about 20 formal therapeutic disclosures, either as the partner's therapist or the addict's therapist.
Wow. Very, very cool. Now, would you share with us your website and how people can get a hold of you?
Yeah, my website is my name. It's VickiTidwellPalmer.com. And if people want to know more about working with triggers, and I've created a 7-step process for working through triggers for partners, it's VickiTidwellPalmer.com/tamingtriggersolution. And you can find out more. I've also written a lot about triggers on my blog recently. And so if you go to my blog, which is on the homepage of my website, you can read a lot of tools and strategies and just kind of my conception of how to work with triggers for partners.
That's wonderful. And how many blogs would you say you have?
Blog posts? I have one blog, but blog posts, oh my gosh. I've been blogging for about 2 years, and you know, it's hard to say. I'd say at least 40. The other thing about my blog too is that you can search it. And I'd encourage partners to search my blog. For example, I've got some guidelines for recovery check-ins. So if you just search my blog for check-ins or how to take timeouts, that's another one that's really helpful for partners, how to take a relational timeout. But you can search my blog for any topics and then read the posts that are related to it.
That is very cool. So one more time, if they want to contact you, they can go to your website, and it is?
VickiTidwellPalmer.com.
Well, okay, and that would be B-I-C-K-I.
Yep. B-I-C-K-I. Tidwell, T-I-D-W-E-L-L. Palmer, P-A-L-M-E-R.
All right. And would you consider yourself more of a partner specialist or an addict specialist or both?
I'd say it's probably 60-40 because I do work with addicts and I enjoy working with addicts for different reasons. But my focus lately, and I think you probably know this, but I've just written a book for partners called Moving Beyond Betrayal. And so recently my focus has been more for partners, and my blog is for partners as well. So, but I enjoy working with both populations.
Yeah, how long did that take to write that book?
I'd say from start to finish it was about a year and a half, even though before that I had thought about it and written just some preliminary work on it. But, you know, I didn't have quite the idea crystallized until later. And, you know, for any aspiring writers out there, too, I'll tell you that a really great way to get a book written is to blog. Because, you know, you can start blogging about what you want to write about, and it's just a great way to keep writing and to be accountable around writing. Because when you know that people are out there and they're, you know, waiting to read whatever you're going to write next, or they're counting on the information, it's a form of accountability. And I think it's really helpful for no matter what you're wanting to write about.
All right. So you would say to anybody who wants to begin to write, they've in their mind formulated that they have some expertise they want to share, start blogging and do that consistently, and that will help you outline perhaps what you want to write for your book.
Yeah, it definitely can. You know, it's one strategy, and it definitely worked for me. And I'm very excited about this book. It's Moving Beyond Betrayal, the 5-Step Boundary Solution for Partners of Sex Addicts, and it will be released in May of this year, and it's available on Amazon right now for pre-order.
Well, that's fantastic. Yes, we'll be looking for that book because I find that for so many people, they don't have certified sex addiction therapists or partner therapists, and they don't know how to get the information they need. And so books and bibliotherapy is the number one way to do that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
All right. Well, we have to end, but is there anything else that you would like to share with our listening audience about triggers?
You know, what I'd like to share is that, especially for partners that are right in the beginning stages of discovery and disclosure, that I really want them to be assured that there are specific things that they can do, whether it's learning self-soothing or all these different strategies that we've talked about, and, you know, including setting boundaries, that there are specific things that they can do that they have power over beginning as soon as they're aware of it to either reduce their triggers or to eliminate them. And I'd also like to add that in the beginning, I think it's completely okay to, you know, use a little bit of avoidance around some things that are triggering. I don't think it's a long-term solution, but I don't want partners, you know, sort of beating themselves up because they really feel like they need to keep themselves safe and not engage in some activities or relationships for a period of time. So I just want them to know that, you know, there are tools, there are things that they can learn how to do to manage them themselves, and that they absolutely do get better and they do go away.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you left that hope, strength, and recovery. They do get better. That you can learn how to turn them down as time goes on and you get stronger and your addict gets stronger or you end up removing yourself from that situation. That combination works really well too. So Vicki Tidwell Palmer, thank you so much for talking about a subject that is just so prevalent in the lives of addicts and their partners. I so appreciate it. Again, your book is coming out. One more time, that book is going to be called Beyond.
Yeah, it's Moving Beyond Betrayal, and the subtitle is The Five-Step Boundary Solution for Partners of Sex Addicts.
Fantastic.
And it's available on Amazon for pre-order.
All right. You make sure to send me an email the week before it comes out so that I can start hyping it up on the show. Partners need that kind of information. Thank you so much.
I will. I'd love that. It'll come out in May, and I look forward to it, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. You have a great week.
Thanks. You too, Carol. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. That was Vicki Tidwell Palmer talking about triggers. And we've had a great show tonight. Thank you so much for listening. As I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. You can get through this no matter whether you're the addict or the partner. We're here to help you. You can go to sexhelp.com. You can go to sexhelpwithcarolthecoach.com. Or you can give me an email. Send me an email at carolthecoach@aol.com. I'm here to help you get through this situation and grow stronger. That's the hope, strength, and recovery of this addiction. Have a wonderful week.